How's that for a happy little sound?
We don't get many Orioles. Charlie, I have totally fallen in love with the Song Sparrow song in my house.
Oh, yeah?
I'm going to listen out for the Oriole now, too, or rely on my Merlin obsession.
Merlin is a wonderful thing. Well, my first Baltimore Orioles last weekend. And I actually got to see one, too. They're so beautiful.
I think only once or twice have I seen them at home. Once in a while, they show up at KXC Studios in Grand Rapids. But
mm-hmm. Yeah, they love riversides. They seem to like being near water. And then they build these fantastic hanging nests suspended from, like, the upper branches of the tree. And they're, like, woven together out of grass. And they dangle from a branch. And they're just, like, this kind of almost sock-looking nest that they construct that's impossible to see during the summer because once the leaves have leafed out, you can't really see them anymore. But I sometimes see them in fall just dangling from the branch. Oh, yeah. Hi, I'm Charlie. This is a Season Watch podcast. That's Heidi.
It's Charlie Mitchell. I'm Heidi Holton. Did you say a sock-like thing?
Yeah.
Okay. It sounds to me like almost like a little Oriole hammock.
Yeah, I like that better.
You know?
Let's go with hammock.
Yeah.
Except it's kind of more tubular than hammocky.
Okay. So I was on the hammock bandwagon there because when you were saying they like to be by the riverside, I'm like, check, so do I.
Yep.
Like by the water. You know, then I'm thinking, oh, hammock. Yeah, they're the Orioles.
Nice little hammock by the water.
Putting human things once again to critters. Oh, well, that's okay.
That's allowed. So how did Strip Unbound go? You have any stories you want to share?
Strip Unbound, John Latimer and I were there for a Season Watch Phenology podcast appearance, and it went great. We had Chad Caddett show up from Little Falls Middle School, and we had Dave Murphy from the Bloomington School, and we had a Star Tribune, Lisa McClintock. She's got a third name, can't remember, but we're going to have her on sometime soon on the podcast. And so many people there, you know, relatives of John's or relatives of mine.
Of course, no, always good.
But also just people who wanted to get a little more engaged and stories of how nature, it reminded me of what we talk about, right? How nature can bring us together and make us feel more grounded. Yeah, it was a really fun event, and thanks to the Star Tribune for inviting Phenology and Season Watch Pod to that.
Yeah, I was sad I couldn't make it, but it sounded like a good event. You met a lot of good people.
Yeah, and you know, it's a good reminder for this country bumpkin that there are beautiful forested areas right in the middle of the city.
There sure are.
I did not make it to the Eloise Butler wildflower area.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's just like a separate area from where we were at, but I want to go back. I want to see that.
Yeah, well worth visiting. I remember maybe last year, the year before, there was an owl that made a nest there, and people could just, like, middle of the city, go watch an owl family.
Wow.
I forget what kind of owl. I feel like it might have been a screech owl. Amazing.
So what's on your nature love and mind this time of year? Is it the birds?
Oh, right now it's just green. It's just like overwhelming quantities of green when you look out the window. Has that happened in Grand Rapids yet? I assume not. It's
not
probably
quite.
Still pretty.
We're a little bit of the, you know, the lighter, almost neon-y green, but small.
Yeah.
We're at that point.
Kind of the tennis ball green-yellow type.
Exactly. I was nodding my head because on Morning Edition this week, they had a story about Alaska's green up in Fairbanks, Alaska, where, you know, they spend the whole winter in dark. But because then they do have so much light, the green up is this super dramatic moment. And so they were talking to a woman about, like, what she does on that green up day. And she was saying, I call all my friends and family and tell them I love them. And I, you know, she was just like so excited for this green up moment.
And it, you know, it may not be as dramatic as it is in Alaska, but it's still extremely dramatic, the change here. And every year I tell myself that I'm going to go, like, take a picture at the same spot every day to see the green up happen. And every year I do it and then I get lazy.
Yeah.
And I miss a few days. But I did it this year, and it's just I think it's a 6-day window in between when I took the first one and then when I managed to take the second one. And the difference is just so dramatic. It happens so fast.
Yeah. I'm always amazed by, because I'm talking to you from Bemidji today, and then I'll be back in Grand Rapids tomorrow morning. Mm-hmm. And it was just a couple days ago I was on the air from there. And I bet it will look different out the window tomorrow. Like it starts to be, the river starts to get covered up and you don't see the water anymore. That's always amazing to me, aside from the color part of it. It's like all these things we've gotten used to seeing over this season are gone. Like we don't see our neighbors anymore. We don't see, you know, it's just like, it's really, it's this cocoon of green that I'm on board for.
Yeah. Nature's own privacy screen. It's also interesting because I feel like summer is both louder than winter, but also quieter, where we don't hear the road noise once it greens up.
Oh, because it buffers it?
There's just a buffer in between, and like we don't hear our neighbors as well. But then you've got all the bird song and just kind of the chaos of summer.
That's right. I've been dying to tell you. I was working from home the other day, and Tom rarely comes to interrupt my work meeting, but he did. He busted in, and because there was a pelican. We'd never had a pelican outside our place before, so that was super fun to see.
They are such magnificent birds. That's so cool. I really love pelicans for a lot of reasons. One, they remind me of when I was growing up. I would go to this cabin in Canada for 2 weeks every summer, and we would see pelicans there. And then in graduate school, our fieldwork place called Turtle Camp had pelicans around all the time during spring migration, which is when we tended to be there in May and June. And we would get to watch these flocks of pelicans as they cooperatively hunt. So they kind of like move in this giant ring of pelicans and then all dabble in the middle. But they work together to move schools of fish. It was so cool to watch.
Wow.
And they are such beautiful flyers too. And seeing like big columns of them rise up on a thermal.
Yeah.
Gorgeous birds.
There was a big talk about thermals on the Tuesday morning show. And I know folks will be able to listen to the full conversation with Pam Perry. And so I had told her about that, and she kind of was explaining that, and they were talking about the thermal, how you see them and then you don't see them, and all that cool stuff. So folks can listen to more in-depth pelican talk then.
Yeah. Good old pelicans. And I also, in yesterday's morning show, I pulled out a note from John about how trees handle drought and how to, you know, help your trees through periods of drought.
I am so glad you did this. I went home saying, we've got to water our trees. And then I forgot the specifics that he had talked about, although it seems like more water than you'd expect. But, you know, there you go. We're in dry times here. Let's take a listen to John Latimer.
Kevin Anderson sent us a note. He said, a question for phenology. After years of drought, observing trees, gardens, and yards getting drier and drier, at what point is watering necessary to save trees, garden, and yard? If so, how often and how much water? I had heard years ago that you needed an inch of water per week for every tree, and that water needed to be on the ground in the circumference of the crown of the tree. So an inch of water right around the trunk of the tree is fine, but you need to get that inch of water into a, 20 or 30 foot circle if you're talking about a large tree. Now, the larger the tree, the deeper the roots, the more it will have its own abilities to find water. But keep an eye on your tree. And if your tree starts to look a little bit stressed, water it. Give it some water. I did a little online search to find maybe a scientific answer. And what I found was 10 gallons per week per inch of trunk diameter. So if you take a 10-inch tree, you would need 100 gallons of water a week. And that's a lot. I suspect that maybe is all that a tree could use. But of course, you know that the tree is losing moisture through its leaves constantly. It is diffusing moisture. Oh, it opens the stoma on its leaf, and water leaks out, and carbon dioxide and oxygen leak in, and ultimately the tree is going to waste out the oxygen and sequester the carbon. So not a clear answer, I realize, but at my house, I sort of watch the tree. If the tree looks stressed, I give it water. If it's a tree that I'm expecting to get fruit from, like an apple or cherry or Juneberry or something like that, I am extra careful to make sure that those get extra water, because that's a pretty intensive prospect to build fruit with not a lot of water.
Yeah, I like that note a lot. And I know the gallons of water that he mentioned there was pretty overwhelming. But keep in mind that your larger trees have these tap roots that go deep, deep underground. There are water sources underground that they can pull from. So I would not say, like, oh, go out and water your trees 300 gallons a week.
You live in forested, you have tons of trees where you live. Do you guys watch for that? Are you watering your trees?
The short answer is no. The longer answer is we have a crabapple tree here that my mom planted in honor of my grandma, who loved crabapples. And we definitely give that one a little bit more care. And we'll sometimes move around saplings from, like, if there are trees growing in our garden, we'll move them to a spot in our yard or a clearing left by all the dead ashes. And those saplings we definitely baby a little bit more and give them a little bit more water. The full-grown trees, we don't do much. Sometimes if there's like an extended period of drought, I will go out and, you know, use the, what do you call that thing that you use to water plants with? Like a little, it's a little bucket, but with a spout. It's a very normal word.
A spigot? No.
Nope.
A little bucket?
Watering can.
Watering
can. Okay.
Oh,
got
okay.
It.
I was thinking you were talking about connected to a hose, so I was thinking you were talking about that.
No, okay. You know, our hose won't reach all of our maple trees.
Sure.
So sometimes I will go out with a watering can and give them a little dribble, which I'm sure is nothing to the tree, but makes me feel better to say thank you to all of our maple trees.
And are you skipping while you do that with your watering can?
I should be.
Hello, trees.
I grow little fairy wings and just flit around.
Of course you do. But, you know, it's a good reminder. We're in drought. You know, we're really in need of rain, and it's not just the pretty flowers that need the water.
Yeah. I think the larger picture is that, you know, our climate is changing, and if you have trees that are going to need constant watering for the rest of their 100-year lifespans, a question that I would pose is, are you willing to commit that kind of time, energy, and water to maintaining that tree? Or, you know, the DNR, the University of Minnesota, both have fantastic resources on climate-ready trees, or ones that are predicted to be more resistant to climate change for different areas of Minnesota. And so especially if you're in a place like where we live, where the Emerald Ash Borer came out and took out a lot of trees, or up in Bemidji when so many were blown down, maybe looking at, you know, some of those recommendations as you, you know, plant or reforest, so that you can plant trees that aren't going to need that kind of sustained care to survive.
It's funny you should say that. Earlier on the morning show today, we talked with some folks about the derecho that happened last June in Bemidji and the loss of almost 9 million trees in this region.
Yeah.
And they are doing a survey right now. We'll put a link to it in the Season Watch pod because we'll get that story up as well. But, you know, they want to know some real logistical things, like, do you still need help, like with your roof or, you know, clearing the trees, but also the, like, emotional impact. They were talking about, we've been having some high winds around here, 30, 35 miles an hour, more than that, and how it can be a trigger now for folks from Bemidji because of what happened. And so they also are looking for emotional impacts of what happened. And, you know, we had done some stories last summer about our connection to trees specifically and what that means to have them gone. There was a loss of some eaglets in the park here in Bemidji because of all the trees that went down and everything. So it's a big part of our lives that we don't always pay attention to, the trees. But
Yeah. I mean, I'm looking out my window right now at this stand of white cedars, and the number of birds I've seen flitting through these branches and, like, the time I spent as a kid in the shade here, it provides, like, some wonderful, I don't know if you've ever had white cedar tea.
No.
Oh, it's so good, especially in the winter. Very okay. refreshing. And white cedars, at least in our area, are the only ones you will see are mature adult trees. The young ones are almost completely decimated by white-tailed deer,
okay.
which love to eat them. And so we have a couple of them that we've planted that we try to tend to a little bit. But yeah, it would be a really sad loss for me and my connection to like this property to mm-hmm. no longer have those cedars here.
Right.
And I don't know, I think especially if you're a kid lucky enough to grow up next to some trees or a tree, they're just steady,
yeah,
wonderful companions.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. Friends. Steady, mm-hmm. wonderful companions. I like it. We're tree huggers is essentially what you're saying here, Charlie.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah.
Going back to the watering thing, I also wanted to mention the impact of your lawn on your tree or your trees. So conventional grass lawns, A, require a lot of irrigation just for the lawn to survive, but also it's very easy for any rain that falls onto those lawns not to stick around for long because there's no leaf litter or shrubbery, etc., to hold some of that moisture down in the soil. So it's very easy for that to evaporate or to run off. And so another thing that trees really rely on is that water sticking around. So the more you can have, you know, native plants in your lawn or leave the leaf litter so that the leaf litter can hold some of that moisture in. Mosses are great for that too. But that's another real bonus of planting, of getting rid of conventional lawns and planting something more like, I know there are sedges that mimic kind of the look and feel of a traditional lawn, but are native and better for pollinators and also better at water retention. But also if you can, you know, plant native wildflowers and stuff like that, that'll not only help your trees, it'll help the pollinators and it'll help, you know, improve that water retention and provide more filtration for that water so that when it does run off into a stream or river, it's cleaner. So another way to help keep your trees watered, get rid of that lawn.
There you go. And one more thing off of your to-do list
mm-hmm.
to mow.
Yeah.
So trees and growing this and green this time of year, of course, then we're thinking about birds. And it's always a delight to talk to Pam Perry, but she was on fire this week.
Oh, Minnesota in May. Who isn't on fire?
Yeah.
It's great.
We'll take a listen to Pam Perry now.
And I've been watching yellow-rumped warblers at my feeders. They've been eating suet. I've been having, seven or eight, you know, something like that every morning. And they're hungry because we've had these cold nights.
Yeah.
And the change this morning, not one showed up.
Wow. Yeah.
So they moved. They decide, okay, time to go somewhere else.
You know, your friend and mine, Mike North, had mentioned something about this a couple of weeks ago, that they were huddled around his suet feeder. And I was kind of like, how come I haven't seen any? I have a suet feeder out, but they didn't come to mine. I suspect that they found something along the way. But he mentioned the same thing, that they were kind of jammed up around these sources of fat, food that they couldn't find just out in the wild. So,
yes. And I texted with him. We went back and forth. We were checking in quite a bit. He had a couple dozen of the warblers. And then because he's a bander, he was banding them and weighing them. And of course, you know, just taking advantage of the opportunity to have them right there in his yard and do that. And one morning he texted me that he had re-caught one of the warblers. It had only lost just a little weight overnight. And, you know, they were doing well enough. And yellow-rumped warblers can do that because they're more adaptable. They can eat more different kinds of food than many of the other warblers, which some of the later warblers that come in, yeah, they're just insect eaters. And I think we all know the insects are coming, but the numbers aren't out there yet.
Yeah,
for sure.
You know, one of the things that has occurred over the years in years like this, where we have lingering cold and a sort of a reduction or at least a delay in the advent of insects, is that people will report things like scarlet tanagers or blue indigo buntings or other birds that you almost never see at your feeder coming to the feeders because that's the only place they can find sustenance.
And that's, yeah, that's where they find food. And they come in, they go where they need to go.
There's your Butterbutt Warblers.
Butterbutt, the fantastic other name for yellow-rumped warbler.
I know, I don't remember that one, but Malachi likes to use that one, even though he's not a birder, remember?
Mm-hmm. No, of course not. Yes, he is. Yeah, I love yellow-rumped warblers, and they're such amazing generalists for a warbler. You know, most warblers only eat insects, as Pam Perry mentioned, and the yellow-rumped warbler is just fantastic at finding food sources. I've seen one, like, pluck insects out of spider webs.
Wow.
That's some good foraging. That's creativity.
I did have some warblers show up, I think a yellow-rumped one, on Merlin when I was on the deck the other day, but not able to see it. You know, I'm hearing it, but there you go. Then you at least know it's there and can try to pay attention a little bit more. Mm-hmm. We got a call this week, what we always ask for, right?
Yep.
Not a call, a voice memo. Here we go.
Hello, my name is John. I'm a Season Watch listener from North Carolina. And in early June, I'm planning a week-long trip to the Iron Range of Northeast Minnesota. I'm going to do some mountain biking and probably tour the Sudan Underground Mine, among other things, outdoors. I am worried about the black fly nuisance. I've heard it could be a problem in late spring, early summer. I'm wondering if the forecast is for a bad black fly season this year, or if not, I'm wondering if you have recommendations on how to handle it. Is it true that they're only really active around dusk and dawn? Or what type of sprays, like DEET spray, do you recommend?
Well, I'm an expert on black flies, so here we go. No. do you know anything about this?
I know some things about it. So where I live in Minnesota, black fly problem isn't as much of a issue as it is further north. It tends to be more of an issue in boreal forest. And we're right on the edge of the boreal forest and the eastern deciduous forest where I am. What I understand about our black flies is, so their larvae live in fast-flowing fresh water. So not necessarily your lakes and ponds, but more in rivers and streams is where their larvae.
Okay.
So they aren't as dependent on, you know, those kind of like ephemeral puddles or pools like we think of our mosquitoes breeding in.
Mm-hmm.
The larvae have a much more stable, always there source for their larvae to breed. So I don't, to the best of my knowledge, there wouldn't be any reason why you would have some years really heavy and some years not, at least in terms of the way that we kind of look at that with mosquitoes. What's your experience been with black flies in terms of dawn, dusk, middle of the day?
You know, I don't know if I just don't remember, but I don't even think of black flies as being an issue. Mosquitoes, of course.
Yeah.
And certain times a year when I'm out on the boat, the horse flies are terrible. They are a terrible biter. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about black flies.
No, so the black flies are also called gnats or no-see-ums.
Oh, sure.
They're those tiny little ones.
Yep.
That hurt like the dickens when you get bit.
I still don't think of it. Like, I would never think ahead like John just did to see what the what the black fly situation would be. And I might just be mistaken. We'll have to kind of look into that a little bit more. And
I know John Latimer gets got by them.
Okay.
But because he does complain about them seasonally. What I understand about them is they kind of taper off at the end of July. So maybe next time plan a trip for August.
Mm-hmm.
Of the repellents that are available, DEET does work. The terrible name, ethyl butylacetylaminopropionate, or IR3535, is a component in some insect repellents. So that should work. DEET and picardin should all work. But the areas that they really like to bite, since they aren't you know, a mosquito will like inject you and draw your blood from under the skin. The way that black flies get you is they essentially stretch your skin tight and then use a little mouth part that's kind of like a rasp to irritate your skin until you bleed, and then they lap up that blood. So they really are going to areas of your skin that are thinner, so around your eyes, around your ears, which is part of the reason they're so dang annoying, is that they're in your eyeballs. And so for that, really, a bug net is going to be your friend.
Okay.
Because that'll keep them away from your eyes, your ears, and so on. Honestly, windy days, they're so tiny, they get blown away easily by the wind.
Okay.
If you're biking, you really shouldn't have a problem with black flies while you're moving.
Right.
They can't keep up with you.
I'm sure you can. You could get a hat that's a bug cover, mm-hmm. too, that hangs down from a...
Yep.
Yeah.
Or even just, you know, there are those rechargeable little personal fans.
Yeah.
One of those even could probably help you out.
Oh, okay.
The places that... reportedly, they're more active at dawn and dusk. I have certainly gotten by black flies in the middle of the day when I'm up in Canada, where the black flies are more of a problem. But they hang out in the bottom of the canoe where they're protected from wind. Okay. So I really think figuring out ways to keep a breeze going by you is going to really help with black flies. I also think they're not as bad as they used to be. Unfortunately, the like widespread use of pesticides and insecticides, it's good for the black flies, it's bad for the birds.
Yeah.
And everything else. Not only because there are fewer insects to eat, but also if you think about a single warbler, how many insects it's eating, think of how much pesticide it's ingesting. It's called biomagnification. But I don't know, I wouldn't anticipate there being big issues with your trip to Minnesota and black flies. A couple of simple precautions and you should have a great time.
And John, we want you to report back, or while you're here, please leave another SpeakPipe message. We will talk about this next week, too. I'll bring it up to John Latimer.
Yes.
So we get a little more insight from him on black flies. And maybe I just have wanted to shut it out of my head. Now I feel like I'm going to have a bad black fly summer because I'm thinking about it. So.
Yeah. What's that frequency illusion where as soon as you hear about something, you see it everywhere?
Yeah. I'm a little afraid of that. Well, we're almost out of time for the Season Watch Pod. I do want to get in one of our student reports today.
Hello, my name is Braylon. This is our phrenology report from Mr. Cody's third grade classroom at East Rapids Elementary. Spring is springing and things are budding. Even oaks are budding. Buds are softening. The box elder is in full flower while willow and red maple are done flowering. Our birch, basswood, and silver maple are in bud break. The buckthorn and nannyberry are in full leaf out. We are seeing loons, otters, fawns, and bears. Oh my! Have a nice day, Braylon.
Braylon, thank you for that.
Amazing. And that's one of the schools that John gets to visit every week. Man, lucky kids. And what a wonderful time to be outside and noticing things.
Part of the conversation that we had last week for the live event with Strib Unbound was about how kids' mindset is better if they're out in nature in the middle of the day. I mean, it's sort of the recess effect, of course, but even more so by noticing nature and being out there, that they're more, their tension's back when they get back in, and, you know, it's a refresher of sorts.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things I will notice, having gone out with John with those classrooms, is they're outside, which is definitely recess-like, but those kids are focused while they're out there. You know, the teachers keep them on task, and they also just naturally kind of lock in. John is such a natural educator.
Speaking of Strib Unbound, we had a chance to meet a daughter of one of our early phenology classrooms, Mr. Belgums in Crosby, and we had a chance to meet Holly. Holly listens to this podcast, so Holly, hi.
We're expecting
speak pipe messages from you and from your mom, Colleen, and from your sister as well. Phenology meant so much to them as they grew up, as their dad was one of the instrumental people and meant so much to John Latimer. from his Crosby classroom. So it was very cool to meet you, and we're going to keep in touch and strong arm you into leaving messages, because it's just inborn in Holly to be noting what's different.
Yes, please. Nature. I didn't get to meet you, so I would love to hear your voice.
Yeah. So thanks so much for that. So let's give a thank you to the sounds that we heard this week.
Yes. So those sounds were all recorded by Jonathan Jongsma, the Baltimore Oriole, and the Yellow-Rumped Warbler. And then thank you to John from North Carolina for our SpeakPipe message.
And John Latimer and Pam Perry, and of course, the state of Minnesota for helping us with the students, the LCCMR.
The Environmental and Natural Resources Trust Fund.
There we go.
Always a supporter of our phenology program. Huge thanks to them.
If you want more nature stuff, check out KAXE.org. You can hear a full John Latimer phenology report and more. And please get involved with us. Leave us a SpeakPipe voice message. And Charlie, until next week, we'll be back for the Season Watch Pod.
Support for Season Watch Podcast comes from the Sugar Lake Lodge near Grand Rapids, a Northwoods setting on the shores of Sugar Lake, offering lodge rooms, cabins, and golf villas, with on-site dining, a golf course, and access to the lake, trails, and seasonal outdoor recreation throughout the year. Plan your stay at sugarlakelodge.com.